Okay, I'm on. Depends which way you would like it. We could make this show up a little more. See that light switching back shut? Is that preferred? Okay, good. I've teased Hugh before. I'm trying to get him to use one of these things so he doesn't have to be tied to his computer. Have you noticed he's constantly just right here in front? I've tried to get him to evolve, but so far, you know, and it's only microevolution I'm wanting him to evolve, you know, but Mark, where's Mark? He came up with that joke. Okay. What I'm going to try to do, and part of me is thinking I have to be absolutely insane in this class to try to go through about 100 PowerPoint slides. Mm-hmm. It takes you usually about 6 months. Okay? So, maybe I'm naive, but I'll see how far I can get through this. And it's more high level. It's not so much maybe drastic new information for at least most people in this class, but it might be good in the sense of how do you approach a person and sort of a, if you have a short period of time, a capsulized period of time, how do you present the evidence against evolution to especially young people, of course, to anyone? And so this is an attempt at that. I was asked to teach about a week ago, so I had to hurriedly come up and take previous PowerPoints that I've done for much more lengthy presentations, and sort of I had to cut one in half, which hurt greatly, being the information freak that I am, and modify it. So when approaching the topic of evolution, especially to young people, I have to first understand that where they're coming from. Do they hold to moral absolutes, for example, or any kind of absolutes? Because a lot of them don't. Down at the promenade in Santa Monica, where my apologetics Bible study goes, we go down there and I get to play Bible Answer Man, which is always fun. You know, one individual can't, so there's no such thing as absolutes. And, yeah, are you sure about that? And said, okay, we got one. I said, does the sun rotate around the sun? I mean, the moon, the earth rotate around the sun. He thought for a moment. He said, yeah. Okay, now we have two absolutes. Am I talking to you right now? He said, yeah. Okay, we've got three absolutes. Wow. And we can go on and on. So the point was there are absolutes. And I doubt even the most moral relativist would deny the existence of physical absolutes, such as the ones that I just mentioned. And I said, so if absolutes exist in the physical realm, that opens up the possibility, at the very least, that they also exist in the moral realm. And so it sort of helps set the stage, especially for people going through college who might be almost literally brainwashed, in a sense, by the teaching of moral relativism, that there are no absolutes. And so they could see in the physical realm that there are. And so I would first, in terms of evolution, evolution doesn't really exist until you get to the issue of life. So going back to the Big Bang is really going before the fact, because it's not involving life. But I think it's good to go back to this point when talking with someone. It makes the point readily clear. So I ask, what facts are universally agreed upon? That's not saying every single human being on the planet, because you always have somebody that maybe believes that the world is flat. There are still a few of those around, by the way. Go on the internet. It's the Flat World Society. But for all practical purposes, what facts are universally agreed upon by astronomers and astrophysicists? Who would like to take a guess in regard to the Big Bang? What's universally agreed upon?
Beginning.
That there's a beginning to what?
To the universe.
Mm-hmm. All matter.
Space, energy, and time.
Uh-huh. I use the acronym STEM. Or METS, if you're a baseball fan. Okay? Space, time, energy, matter. They all had a beginning. Okay? So, and this is universally agreed upon by astrophysicists and astronomers. Except for Hugh Ross. No. You know. Okay. So, since space, time, energy, matter all had a beginning, what conclusion can you draw from that?
They will end.
Yes, that's one of the Big Bang basic tenets, is that the universe will die, an entropic heat death, eventually no more usable energy. But in this time frame of at the beginning, what does this mean?
That someone or something had to make it begin.
Right. So, since everything had a beginning, you can conclude that the universe had to have a pre-existing agent or agency that started it.
That's not exactly... there's some people that think that it could have always been. You know, that why does it need a beginning? It doesn't really have to have a beginning. It could have been always existed.
Well, that's called the steady state theory, okay? And the steady state theory has gone out of favor totally with the astronomical community, the scientific community. And so according to all the evidence that we have at this time, the universe had a beginning. Now, I'm going to go back just a second. See that? Isn't that... that's a lot of pretty stars in there, isn't it? Oh, who said galaxies? Yeah, actually, those are all galaxies, not stars. That's from the wide field WIFP pick. Yeah, the deep field on Hubble. And that was shot in an area of about that big. It's about the diameter of a straw. So some of those galaxies go back to almost the beginning. There's just another example of some stars in our galaxy. I say, if you had a dot, if you had, take a closest two dots, let's say on this, like Earth is about, let's say, there, and the closest dot would be our nearest star called Alpha Centauri, 4 1/3 light years. You realize traveling at 25,000 miles an hour, it would take you 120,000 years to get there? So that shows you just how big space is. So, there's a nebula. That's something that we have came from. But the Big Bang is also supported by Einstein's theory of relativity, and parts of it up to 15 decimal places. You can't get much more certain than that. Stepping out in the morning off onto your front porch doesn't have that level of certainty that you will not make it to your car, you know. And, of course, it's supported by the second law of thermodynamics. Yes, Steve?
About stepping out and not being certain to get to the car in that last slide of 99.999. I think we need to go back and be challenged on the basic assumption of that we're coming from absolutes. Seeing the stars, we recognize that we give God the quality of omniscience, much bigger than us. But yet we tend to take on that same, ask to take on the same quality and call it absolutes. And I'm proposing that it gets us into problems with evolution, with science, with everything. Especially as Christians, we need to consider that we're not omniscient. And what that means in daily practical life is that we cannot absolutely say that there are absolutes. We're not God. We're not omniscient. I can get on a plane and be agreeable universally with other people that it's going to fly, but I'm not omniscient enough to say I'm 0.9999 or 1 trillion and 1. It may not follow aerodynamical laws. Now, that is a pretty thin sliver, but
right.
It really comes down to, you know, we have laws that we agree on. We don't know laws absolutely. It's just that they tend to happen. And I'm saying when it's not a sliver, it is when we get to things where really there is a lot of mystery and we tend to go one way or another and we treat it. And evolution is one of those.
Well, I would say, in terms of a practical sense, note the word practical. There's philosophical, theoretical arguments that one can bring up, which I find probably most of those impractical or irrelevant. I had a geometry teacher that once said, if the Greeks had not debated philosophy so long, we would have been on the moon 500 years ago, which that might very well be true. You know, but on a practical level, I would contend there are absolutes that we depend on every day. You know, an absolute, there's oxygen in our atmosphere. There's an absolute, we're on a spherical body called Earth, and so on. So we could point to a number of absolutes. But there are areas where true. That we have to tread lightly and be careful to say something is an absolute.
What I'm calling you on directly is that you're calling what is absolute. You're calling what is not absolute as an absolute, and it gets us into problems later on where we need to have some comparative humility to God, who is omniscient. Oftentimes we
is that an absolute?
It's an unknown, and we and it's not an absolute, and that's a good point. We give that characteristic to God, and we operate on that because we're not omniscient. Point made.
Okay. Yes.
I was going to bring up one of those irrelevant philosophical arguments.
Okay.
Steve just alluded.
Do you have any Greek background?
No, but I know there's a couple of people in here who are really trained in that. I mean, there is some philosophical thing that either proves there are absolutes we can know or that we cannot know. I don't know which it is.
And I'm not demeaning philosophy. It has very good aspects to philosophy. But when you get to the point where some people argue the fire hydrant out, there might be a foreign god observing you, and you try to disprove that logically, you know, they can run circles around you all day long, and that's where we get into nonsense. You know, but yes, sir.
When I was a kid, I was told that the times table was always true, and it will always be true.
The time?
The time table.
Ah, yes. At least in this universe it is, I would say. 2 times 2 will always equal 4, at least in this universe. Okay? Now, the second law of thermodynamics, note I say a law. There's never been found an exception to this law. Never. So for practical purposes, we can state, so far, it's been an absolutely true statement that everything ends, everything dies, everything, in the case of the universe, end of usable energy at some point. And like I like to tell people, just look at yourself in the mirror year after year. That's second law of thermodynamics. Okay? And so everything grows old. Therefore, the universe had to have a beginning by deductive logic. Because if you never had a beginning, that means the end would have happened also an infinitely long time ago. Because the second law says everything wears out. So if everything started infinitely long period back there somewhere, the end would have also been reached and we wouldn't be here this morning. So we could say the second law so far has proven to be an absolutely true statement, and therefore the universe had to have a beginning. So then I like to ask young people, you know, what agent brought it into being? Or agency? You're getting better, Al. It happened on my watch.
We don't know any better.
Yeah.
Sure.
And until you come up with a better explanation, we'll stick with that one.
Okay. I'll get to one, but eventually.
Yes, sir.
Actually, Al just said a while ago that things can be existed forever.
Mm-hmm.
A while ago. So, but anyway, my question was, so you can prove that the universe that started by taking the mathematics backwards.
Sure. And the visuals. Of course, we can't go back visually to the Big Bang, but we can get pretty close to it. Pretty less than 1% of the time frame we can get back to that point. You know, but yes.
The first thing, nothing short-circuits my brain.
Uh-huh.
Trying to think back to eternity past. The idea of either stuff existed forever
mm-hmm.
into the past and we had no beginning, or God did. Mm-hmm. It's looking outrageous. I mean, how can God not have a beginning? Seems outrageous, but mm-hmm. I'd rather believe that than.
Mm-hmm. Well, the secular, the materialist, I have my response to them. Of course, they always ask, well, God, did he have a beginning? And I simply say, well, in this four-dimensional universe, including time, we know everything has had to have a beginning. Everything. If you step outside our four-dimensional universe, who are you to say something has to have a beginning in that dimensional reality? And God is at least beyond 10 dimensions, if string theory is right. And so we cannot state with any kind of certainty that you have to have a beginning in that kind of dimensional reality or beyond that dimensional reality. And so the believer in God has much less of a logistics problem than the non-believer in God in that sense.
I'm an elementary school teacher. Mm-hmm. I think we teach our basic geometry. We have line segments, mm-hmm. we have two endpoints. We have a ray which has one endpoint. And we have a line which has no endpoint. And people ask me, the kids ask me, well, can you give me an example of line? And the only thing I can think of is God.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, Al.
You know, though, again, if you say, okay, God created that. Now, that begs the question. Now, who created God? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always got to be something else.
Well, did you hear what I just said? When you get beyond our four-dimensional reality, who is to say that beginnings are necessary? That's hypothetical, obviously. But at least you're in less of a dilemma than the non-believer in God who is limited to these four dimensions. And everything in these four dimensions have a beginning.
That is the biggest hypothetical of all. We don't know. We never
well, we're going to see that that's not true. Yes. Yes.
Philosophers have very carefully examined the question of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I often derive this from what Einstein said. He thought it was more remarkable that anything exists at all
mm-hmm.
than nothing at all ever exists. But anyway, it turns out if you really carefully trace out causality, it turns out that an infinite regression of causes is insufficient. That you must come to the conclusion that there must exist something which is uncaused. And something, in order for anything at all to exist, there must be mm-hmm. something which is self-existent,
mm-hmm.
exists of itself. And in space-time, that would have to be recognized as something eternal, something that is transcendent.
Mm-hmm. And also the law of cause and effect.
Yeah.
That the effect cannot, by deductive logic, be greater than the cause. And since you see people with personalities running around, that means the agency that started the universe has to be at least personality plus. It cannot be inanimate. Because inanimateness cannot result in personality. Okay? There's a Vela supernova. Maybe that's what decreased our age span at the time of the right after the flood. We don't know. But that's a possibility. So, at this point, a young person or somebody may ask, what if there's an infinite number of universes being produced out there? Like a giant bubble generator machine that produces an infinite number of bubbles over an infinite amount of time, and it's just that our universe happened to get everything right, which we'll get into the fine-tuning in a moment, as evidence for God and against evolutionary thought. Well, there's a number of problems with the multiverse. One, there is zero evidence for it. None. Nada. Zip. It never existed until recently, because the Big Bang has become so firmly entrenched that there's a beginning, therefore it requires a beginner. Some people don't like the theological implications of that, so they've come up with what's called a multiverse, which I just defined. But the problem is, there's zero evidence for it. It's all philosophical. It's not due to any evidential criteria or facts, because there's none. The theory of relativity also says you can't see, as Hugh has said many times, you can't see outside our space-time theorem. And therefore, whether there is something out there or not, we'll never see it. And therefore, such an idea is never testable. Yes?
Is that what Stephen Hawking is trying to come
up
with?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so he wants to go back, kind of like, instead of going back to the steady state that
almost a multiverse steady state, in a sense. Yeah.
Kind of like that, but it's like nothing had to make something.
The problem with the bubble generator universe theory is what? What's the problem with that one? Other than the fact that we can't test it, and there's no evidence for it at all. Other than that, what's wrong with it?
Well, whether there's one bubble created or gazillion bubbles created, there's still a bubble there.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we go with this creating?
Who designed the generator? And what does the generator violate? This idea. What law?
Second law of thermodynamics.
Everything has to have a beginning. Okay, so it contradicts that.
Well, you need a god for each universe.
Now you got all these gods to deal with, Al. I mean,
they're out there in bubble land again. Lots of gods.
Well, being the Star Trek person I am, I'll quote Captain Kirk in one episode. He says, "Thank you, the one god is enough." I think that was from the first season, Apollos, if I remember the title. You see how Trekkies we go. Yes.
Absoluteness, 99.99%. Perhaps we should think of the resurrection as maybe the most unusual thing that did not fit the laws, and therefore becomes very attractive to what is not normal and defines God. So to our Christianity, Paul said resurrection is everything.
Okay. Yes.
Again, when something doesn't fit the mold, we need to pay attention.
Okay.
And at one point,
by the way, the next 2 weeks I'll be doing the resurrection at Village Church in Burbank on Wednesday nights. Yes.
I just want to ask you up front, would you feel comfortable that when you use the word absolute, that it implies that for all practical purposes?
For sake of argument, I can agree to that definition. So the multiverse thing is just, what is it? It's blind faith. You know, now there's no evidence for it, can't be tested, and it contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, so we talked about who would design the generator and how could it last forever. So, sort of got ahead of myself. So, let's go to design. So, I'd reply to a young person first, you have a big problem with the universe starting out of nothing. Nothing cannot produce something. If nothing can produce something, we have an absurdity. And so you have to have an agent or agency that started the universe. And since you can't appeal to multiverse, you must appeal, I believe, to an intelligent being. And that is further enhanced by the fact that we have design in the universe. Now, when does design exist in something? Who would like to take a venture at that? How do we know when something's been designed?
When it works good.
Yes.
It serves a purpose. There's a purpose on something that you design.
You mean the various parts of that widget together perform a purpose? Yeah, very good.
If it has order.
Mm-hmm.
If it displays order.
Displays order, recognizable order. Mm-hmm.
meaningful order.
Meaningful, very good. Because the side of a mountain, the side of a mountainside, for example, there's a lot of complex patterns in that, but they're random. They have no specific meaning or purpose, unless you see Mount Rushmore.
Well, what about a crystal has order, but what's its purpose?
Yeah. Yeah. So Mount Rushmore, that's design. Obviously, nobody would think that happened by chance because the patterns fit a recognizable purpose or pattern. Four presidents. Yes, sir.
The second law prohibits self-created structures. If it was a violation of the second law, then self-created structures would be popping out all over the place and the proper universe could exist. So it can't be any self-created structures.
Right, because because according to the second law, everything degrades, and you end up with less information, unless you have input of information from some agency outside the system. And so, believe it or not, the formation of planets and all that—that's degrading. The Big Bang was at its highest level just after the singularity. So, planets, stars, galaxies are the result of eventual degrading. Okay.
It's not degrading per se. It is finding an average of available energy.
It's finding an equilibrium.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that is degrading to that point.
Right.
Until we get to that point, molecules have preponderances that bring them together to form, atoms, molecules, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, the end point will be a degrading to an average of energy of not being able to work.
Mm-hmm.
The difference, and there's a thought, that molecules come together in certain ways that produce, some people would say, life, other people's no. So I would propose this, that design is knowable, and I believe in design. Design is knowable when the object does things that are far beyond the capability of its constituent parts.
Okay. I would contend that the universe was probably more highly organized at the very beginning compared to a million years afterwards or a thousand years afterwards. And in that sense, it's degrading along a constant linear line in that sense. But...
I have one more thing.
I don't think... Yeah, you were on a question there.
Yes.
You were asking...
How do we know if something's designed?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Can I comment?
Information. A design system usually has a form of information. For instance, a low level of information would be like a crystal. You have repeated molecule patterns.
Right, like a snowflake, for example.
A more complicated one would be like DNA in a living system. And it has information to code for it, an object, whatever it is.
I'm going to get to information at the very end.
Right. Well, that,
but that's very, very relevant, very important. Yes, ma'am? Abstract art, you mean? But we know design when we see it. You know, if I held this up and said, has this been designed? There's nobody in this room that say it has not been. Come on. Nobody. Because its component parts are all machined, molded, to accomplish a given purpose. That's design. So where this is relevant to the universe is, we will see that the universe in its component parts are designed to make an Earth-like planet possible and therefore eventually an a life possible. Those are two separate issues. Overlapping, but also separate. You can get an Earth-like planet and not get any life. And so, the components of the say this is the universe, all the different components of it are finely tuned to accomplish a specific purpose. And when you could show individual components of a system are machined or molded or made or constructed in such a way to accomplish a given purpose, you have design. And there's never been an exception to that. Yes, Al?
I think that if you had been there at T or zero...
God was a good friend of mine. I know him. He told me. Yes.
And whatever else in back of him. And at T equals zero, T equals, say, the first picosecond or whatever. And a lot of deists believe this, right? That mm-hmm. he started it.
Yeah, he started and then stepped back.
The whole thing and then just let it alone. Mm-hmm. But if you had been there, you would have seen, as you can see now, if you put that picture back with had all of every star in the sky and every galaxy in it, is that just it's chaos. How can you say it's being designed?
Well, let's see.
I mean, it's chaos.
Let's see.
They're all bumping into each other. we're not going to be around here very long, this planet. You know, so why? How can you say it's designed? If the guy, if that was the design of God, mm-hmm. he didn't do a very good job.
Well, let's see. Again, the fine-tuning of something is for a specific purpose is evidence of design. All right? Now, in terms of the universe, as I said, we could show that it's designed to make an Earth-like planet possible and eventually life. And when design exists, there's always a designer. No exceptions to that. So let's see if it's designed rather than chaotic. Now, one of the top evolutionists, Anthony Flew, who has now passed away,
that's the spell, by the way.
F-L-E-W. He is... McCrack? Okay, thank you. I'll correct that.
F-L-E-W.
Okay, appreciate that.
He just died, I think.
He became a theist in his last few years of life.
Yeah, he got
adult. As you get older, you get wiser, you know? Like, you get older, you become a Republican. No, I'm... you know... and you evolve further into a tea party. Okay, all right.
I didn't become adult.
He said, you've got to go where the evidence leads. He was a very erudite gentleman, not like Madame Murray O'Hara, who was a raving, lunatic, but not clinically speaking, but in her attitude. But he was a very intelligent gentleman. He argued for atheism about 80 years of his life, or 82 years of his life. But he changed to becoming at least a deist, if not eventually a theist. And he said that an intelligent being created the universe, and the two things that he said that brought him to that conclusion were the Big Bang and the fine-tuning of the universe. So, at the end of 2006... there were 676 finely tuned parameters needed to get one, at least one Earth-like planet in the universe that's capable of supporting life. I didn't say life. Capable of supporting it. And as Hugh points out in his materials, that's one chance out of 10 to the 556 power. We'll deal with that figure in a moment. That's one with 556 zeros after it. You know the number of atoms in the universe?
A bunch.
10 to the 79. Was 79. At the end of 2006, one chance out of 10 with 556. And each increment of 1 in an exponent is a multiple of 10. So 10 to the 20th is 10 times more than 10 to the 19th.
Are you taking
and
into
so
account
on.
The number of planets that have already been found? Some like 450-some.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that's just the beginning.
And Kepler has a bunch more.
So
I worked on Kepler for a while.
Mm-hmm. More. So how can you say that? You
know, well, let's look at just the odds.
Fine-tuned for this.
Let me show you something just a moment. Now, here are some of the odds at the end of 2006. How many finely tuned parameters you needed to get your atomic structure, for example, or your galaxy cluster, or 200 finely tuned parameters to get the right kind of galaxy, for example, and so on. Now, in your initial factors of creation, I'm going to look at 3. Okay? Isn't that pretty? This looks like a dragon's head or something. Or T-Rex, or something like that.
Exploding
crash. Okay. 3 of the 4 initial factors. The universe's expansion rate, if it were off by more than 1 out of 10 to the 57th, no life, no Earth, anywhere, anytime. The space energy, meaning dark energy, density ratio, finally tuned to 1 out of 10 to the 120th. Okay. And gravity is one out of 10 to the 40th. That's for gravity. Put those together, and that's one chance out of 217th power that it happened by chance. That's how finely tuned it has to be. Now, what does that figure mean? Okay, let's do this for a moment. 1 out of 10 to the 217th. This shows design. We haven't even started yet. Take all the atoms in the universe. You talk about planets. Forget planets. That's kindergarten play. Let's take atoms. Let's take atoms. 10 to the 79. Okay? Multiply our universe by 1 trillion, 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 by 1 trillion. You're not old enough yet. I know you're advanced in years, but you're not that old. By 1 trillion, by 1 trillion, by about another trillion. And remove one atom.
What?
Remove one atom. No Earth-like planet at any time in the cosmos. That's the degree of precision we're talking about with just three of these parameters. There's a total, actually now, of over 900. Yeah.
Well, on that point, it's so important, and I don't understand it, that it would be wonderful if somebody, maybe he would be the only one, I don't know, could really explain how that works so we can explain it to somebody else. Yeah.
Well, for example, the universe's expansion rate, in brief, if it expanded any slower, you would get too many heavy elements, as I understand it. Too much faster, you would only get light elements, hydrogen and maybe helium. And therefore, no rocky planets.
But one atom is amazing. I just don't understand.
Yeah, it's just beyond comprehension.
I don't understand how they came to that number to say one atom. It's an amazing number. And I'd like to understand that.
No, there's a certain logical extrapolations. Obviously, it's probably not the number, but it's close enough for our purposes anyway. Yes.
Is that the same truth that's illustrated by what Hugh said, that if you took like a sliver of a dime's mass out of the universe, that it wouldn't work? Is that the same thing you're getting at?
Yes.
Is that equivalent to one?
But I went to an atom.
Okay. All right. So it's the same ratio.
It's the same kind of logic, okay. Except I chose an atom instead of a dime to illustrate the point. Now, that's basically what I just verbally did. Yes, Ted?
I think there's something like 10 to the 20th atoms in the sliver of a dime. So you're only off by a factor of 10 to the 20th out of that.
Well, to give you an idea,
not a big deal anyway.
To give you an idea of the numbers, in one drop of water, there's about 10 to the 20th, 21st atoms in one drop of water. There's 10 to the 79 in the whole universe. So it shows you how these numbers, like a breeder reactor, they just multiply like crazy. All right? Now, I talked about that. Sometimes I get ahead of myself. Now, there are other parts that show fine-tuning. Hold on just for a moment. Al, I'll get to you. Look at galaxies, for example. You have to have almost 300 galactic factors just to be perfectly right in order to get a galaxy that's capable of supporting an Earth-like planet. All right? And I'm not going to list all of them. Do I hear an amen? I just listed a few here. In my other presentation, I list a lot more, but I had to cut it down. But these, the galaxy size, the galaxy location, the cluster size, the cluster location, the variability of white dwarf galaxies near the galaxy in question. Also, the majority of galaxies are in too compact of an area. In other words, it's crowded out there. For example, often, I think, what is the number? About 40,000 in a typical cluster, and we have only about, 40 in ours, I believe, if I remember. See, there's two galaxies that eventually they're going to rip each other apart. Now, that's a nice collision. Beautiful, but you wouldn't want to live there. All right? Yep. There's another galactic collision and some more factors. So, only spiral galaxies can contain life. There's many different shapes. You're seeing spirals. So, only about 1% of all galaxies out there are capable of supporting life. Only 1%. Then you get to solar factors. That's actually way too big for the Earth, by the way, in relation. How'd you like to be in that solar flare? But there's about 140 tuned, finely tuned parameters just for a star. Remember, we, according to Hugh, we have not discovered one solar twin yet. And you need pretty much a solar twin in order to get an Earth twin. Okay? So those are some, just a few issues. Yes?
I recall in school, and I think they're still teaching us, but will you guys tell me, don't we say that our sun is a very average star?
You hear that in school.
Is it no longer true?
That is true. Meaning, it is not an average star. It's an average size, yes. Mm-hmm. But then you have about, like I said, about 100 and almost 150 other issues you have to deal with other than size.
Okay.
It's luminosity. It's metallicity content. It's age. Where it is in the galaxy. Now, here, see, if the sun's orbit is too elliptical, no Earth in the galaxy. No Earth. If the sun is not between spiral arms, no Earth. And if it's not the right distance, see, it's about halfway between the center and the outside. All those have to be just right. Now, that's a little more accurate. There's the size of the Earth. See the little pale blue dot?
Oh, yeah.
Right there. And 99.5% of all the mass in our solar system resides in the sun. Believe it or not. And here's just some things you have to look at a star. I listed several others earlier. Here's just a few more that have to be just right. There's another Earth-Sun comparison. Those are really pretty. Now, our sun is not the biggest kind of star. There's a big star. And there's the sun right there. So, quite a difference. Yes?
How big would the Earth be compared to that star?
Well, you could fit 1.4 million Earths in the sun.
How much does he fit in that star?
Into that one? Oh. I don't know. I'll get back to you on that. Yes, Al?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, if there was an intelligent design that God designed us for us humans, that would be a huge, bigger Earth. All right? Why just such a small one compared to all the other garbage around? But the thing is, that I want to make it, getting back to the numbers. I don't know. Somebody's probably done it. But what is the probability that, say, you would be standing there? But you, if you go back to your parents, their parents.
What's the odds I'd be standing here right now?
What is the probability of that?
Probably remote, but nothing near the figures that I'm talking about.
That's what I'm saying about that. And we're here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't use that argument. For example, if I took you to Vegas, and every time somebody pulled a slot machine, they won money. And they do that thousands and thousands and thousands and millions and millions and billions of times. And they win the jackpot every time. What's your logical conclusion?
Yeah.
It's rigged.
Yes.
It's rigged.
It's
you know the owner of the casino. No. Okay. That's the kind of odds that I'm talking about. There's a solar eclipse of Saturn shot by JPL. There have to be about 137 solar system factors that need to be finely tuned. And the distance the planets are from the stars, we've been over this in class, so I need not enumerate all that. Distance from gas giants, for example, Jupiter. If the Earth's distance from the sun were off by more than about 1%, were toast, or ice cubes, as the case may be. Yes?
I was thinking, with regard to the number of Earths in Paris, based on the scale of the portrayal, it's probably between 100 billion and a trillion Earths.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be a pretty reasonable range of
I'll double check your figures this week. Now, there's Jupiter. If Jupiter were just a little farther away, we probably wouldn't be here because it protects us from incoming objects. If Jupiter were a little closer, about 1%, no life on this planet because it would distort our orbit and make it too elliptical. There's the Earth in comparison to Jupiter. 1,400 Earths can fit inside Jupiter. You know the red spot. About 3 to 4 can fit in the width of that thing. So if Jupiter's mass were smaller, no life. If it were less circular, no life. If the orbital plane were much different, you know, most of them are on an orbital plane like this. If it were like this, trouble. And you could go into other Earth, other gas giants. With Earth, there's 268 finely tuned parameters needed, plus 137 surface features of the planet, plus 27 moon features. They all have to be just perfect in order to get an Earth-like planet. And these, I just mentioned a few here. There's, like I said, you get over 200 of these things. So at the end of 2006, rounding up, now we're going to get into evolution finally, there were 676 finely tuned parameters. And the odds, 1 out of 10 to 556. I talked to Hugh about that. And he said recently they had a skeptic come and check all his figures. And they ended up within a factor of 10 of what Hugh calculated. For example, if you have 10 to the 556, a factor of 10 difference would either be 10 to the 555th or 557th. That's how close the skeptic got to Hugh's numbers. So if you took that number and say, fill all our whole universe full of dimes. Ah, we're going to the dimes now. If you'll let me talk next week, we'll talk quarters. But so fill the whole universe full of dimes, which is about 10 to the 60th dimes. And you multiply it by that many trillions. And I'm not going to say that up here. But you multiply it by that many trillion. Oh, and that many trillion times. So that's how many times you multiply our universe by. And you remove one dime, no Earth, anytime, anywhere. That is design of the highest order that you could possibly imagine. It's beyond imagination and conception. And so you could see the universe, all its components are finely tuned to accomplish a stated purpose, to get an Earth-like planet, at least one in the universe. I don't know whether God made two or more. That's his business. Now, that's just to get capable of supporting life, not life itself. For example, physicist Harold Moravitz said that the chances of a simple single bacterium forming by chance are 1 out of 10 to 100 billionth power. I'm not even going to attempt that here, to describe that number. Absolutely impossible. So, if you believe all that happened by chance, Las Vegas would welcome you and give you a free room, and boy, they'd like you to gamble your heart away. They'd love to have you come up there. In other words, it takes a blind faith to believe all that is by chance, because all those things are engineered to accomplish a purpose of getting an Earth-like planet. Yes, Ted?
We should also consider that each one of us has got probably 10 to the 30th atoms compared to the 10 to the 79th for the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And in each one of our little packages is the mind and consciousness. Let's discuss the probability of that coming into existence.
Well, I'm going to get there now.
Okay. It's not a product of the biology.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a product of the physics. It's not a product of the universe.
It's a product of information, which I'll, if I make it, I'll get to that. See some of the quotes. Einstein said, God does not play dice with the universe. That's a famous line that he's known for. He says, in view of such harmony in the cosmos, which I, within my limited human mind, am able to recognize, there are yet people who say there is no God. But what really makes me angry is that they quote me for the support of such views. Yeah, he's not an atheist. He's a deist. He says, I'm not an atheist, and I don't think I could call myself a pantheist. I am not an atheist, quote unquote.
I can get you two more quotes that he made later on.
He is a deist. Of course, we've known about Stephen Hawking. He said it would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us.
Einstein was just in awe of
okay.
the universe.
All right. Now, I don't have time to go through this, several more quotes. There's the moon up there.
How about that?
Paul Davies, who changed from a skeptic to a believer, in a sense, at least of God's existence. The laws of physics seem themselves to be the product of exceedingly ingenious design. He says, it seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. Oppression of design is overwhelming, according to physicist Paul Davies. That's a view toward the center of the galaxy. Here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God. The fine-tuning of the universe provides prima facie evidence of deistic design. At least deistic design. We would claim theistic. A deist is simply a person who believes in an all-powerful, knowing God, but once he got it going, he steps back and does not get involved in the universe's affairs anymore. There's the Cat's Eye Nebula. And I love this quote. That's from an agnostic / atheist down in UC San Diego. Okay, now to finally to Earth. What do you think that's a picture of? Very good. Or at least somewhere during the Hadean era, which lasted from about 4.5 million to about 3.85 billion years ago.
Why did that have to happen?
Ah, it gave us a lot of minerals. A lot of water, too, by the way. A lot of water came. That's probably where most of our water came from. Now, in this, at the peak of the Hadean era, Hades, hell, an appropriate name for this era, at about 3.9 was the peak of the late heavy bombardment. The surface was to a molten depth of 700 feet. However, at 3.9 billion years ago, life has formed. I would ask a young person in college, how can that happen?
Evolution.
How could it happen?
It may have been there before.
Now, while, well, the late heavy bombardment would wipe anything out that may have existed, would be the most reasonable contention. But when I give them an example, I say, you don't understand the complexity of the universe. I say, for example, you don't understand the complexity of a simple bacterium or a protein. You take one simple protein. Proteins are made chains of amino acids from about 50 into the few thousand range. Let's take one that has 200 in its chain, one of the simplest proteins. Note, a bacterium has 2,000 proteins. We're talking just one protein. For that to statistically form by random chance, if you assumed every molecule in the universe had 1 trillion chemical interactions per second, never happened, because when you're talking life on Earth, it's just about what's going on in that little pond over here. Okay? But we're talking the whole universe. Every atom, 1 trillion chemical interactions per second, with a different result each time. Okay? It would take you a universe that's 100 billion times 30 billion years in order to come up with that first simple protein. So, the fact that we had life was not possible on Earth until about 3.85 billion years ago, and we have evidence of life starting at 3.8, and maybe it started earlier. Impossible for evolution, I would say to the young person in the university. You cannot have evolution that quick. It is totally, absolutely impossible. You have the sudden appearance of the universe, the Big Bang. You have the fine tuning that shows design. You have the sudden appearance of life. So that defies evolutionary thought. Also to the young person, I would say that in the sudden appearance of life, if there was a prebiotic soup, there would have to be a prebiotic soup if evolution were true, where you build up more complex chemicals eventually forming life. Well, the fact is, the first indications of carbonaceous deposits come from life processes, the ratio of carbon 12 to 13. So that's the first indication of life. So the prebiotic soup did not proceed, based on the evidence so far. Okay, I'm rushed because I got about 10 minutes, so let me try to get through this. Okay. See, I don't have next week to come back to, so Hugh has that luxury. So I would also point out, too, along this theme that things suddenly appear, the universe suddenly appeared, life suddenly appeared, I say, do you know, dear college student, that in the fossil record, life suddenly appears consistently? The Cambrian explosion, after several major extinction events where most of life is wiped out, but then within a relatively geologic time frame, you have hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of new forms suddenly appearing out of nowhere after major extinction events. That's impossible on an evolutionary scale. Totally, absolutely impossible. You have also systematic regular fossil gaps throughout the fossil record, that your main groupings of animals appear suddenly, fully formed, fully developed, and they stay that way, more or less, until their end. Like Homo erectus, 1.8 million to about 100,000 years ago, he looks the same at the end as he did at the beginning. And that's the classic case of the fossil record. So I said, if evolution were to be true, what would you expect to see in the fossil record? You would not expect to see the Cambrian explosion, which I'll go to in a moment. The sudden appearance of most of animals' structure types, phyla. You wouldn't see that.
Any of that.
In an evolutionary form. That's right. You wouldn't expect to see a bunch of new forms after each major extinction event because it takes evolution billions of years to do things. You wouldn't see systematic regular fossil gaps, would you? You would see animal A changing into animal B by small gradations, small intermediate changes. Let's say birds came from an alligator, which that has been suggested. But I don't think he's the prime candidate, but I'll just use that as an example. We're all familiar with alligator. For an alligator to form into a bird, eventually his forelimbs had to get shorter and shorter and shorter. Meanwhile, all his fellow alligators are making fun of him. But, he's got to have two protrusions in his back that eventually starting to form wings. Now they're really laughing at him. Okay?
And he's defenseless, so they could eat him.
And during those stages, they would kill him. And he wouldn't form into a bird in the first place because intermediate form is to his disadvantage anyway. Evolution doesn't work just on a practical level, does it? The intermediate forms aren't very functional.
So where did God step in?
At the beginning of each animal type, whatever that may be. Huh? But the evidence supports that. That you either have divine creation or natural selection.
Isn't it the museum?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And watch the see the evolution that takes place then?
Do you know
that they have fossils? And
do you know how much false pictures and concepts they have in museums? But if the evolution is true, you have to have billions of transitional forms. Literally billions.
No, you don't.
Well, you and I could talk afterwards, but you do, from changing one type into another, you have to have small gradations, like that alligator gradually changing into a bird would take hundreds of thousands of transitions. There are none of those in the fossil record. There's none. I'll show it to you in a moment. At 543 million years ago, Cambrian, we only had unicellular life forms, simple worms, jellyfish. And then suddenly at 543 million years ago, up to 85% of all the phyla, body structure types like chordata, spinal cord, and so on. That was just one of his main entrances. Up to 85% of all the phyla that ever existed on this planet appeared instantaneously on a geological time frame. We could prove within 2 to 3 million years, and it may even be less than that. But we don't have the tools to get down less than that, even if it happened. Yes. Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to mention, I know that the curator of the British Museum that was in custody of several million fossil specimens said that in all of that collection he was unable to find one transitional form.
Mm-hmm. And Darwin himself acknowledged, he said, if you cannot prove all life forms resulted from fine gradual changes, according to Darwin himself, you have disproven my theory. Okay? And he recognized the Cambrian explosion as being a huge impediment to his theory. He acknowledged that himself. He was hoping that additional evidence would eventually be found through digging in the fossil record. But the situation has only become worse for Darwin. The Cambrian has become even more firmly entrenched. Then you look at your various extinction rates. Permian extinction, 95% of all your marine animals were gone 251 million years ago. Then within a few years, geologically speaking, you have millions of new species. Could not happen on an evolutionary time frame. And so on. Now, as I said, evolutionary theory says small gradations. I have about 4 minutes. Sorry, Steve. I'm going to finish.
Okay, one moment, real quick. I like your idea of fine-tuning equals design.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to suggest that the evolution not equaling design needs to be reconsidered from a theistic point,
mm-hmm.
in that it can. Theism does not believe in randomness, but it does believe that the creation account in Genesis 1 shows progression. That happens to also be the same progression of evolution. And I'm just suggesting a lot of what you're saying today, I could talk about later, but about transitions and so forth, and where the word Barak comes in from the creation,
mm-hmm.
fits evolution really well, yes. Not from a total randomness.
I say, too bad we don't have a second week on this, then we could get into
total
that.
Randomness.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of his name escapes me. You know, Unlocking the Mystery of Life. Dean. What's his name?
Dean Kenyon.
Dean Kenyon. Thank you. He used to believe in biological predestination. In other words, there are certain built-in laws that, well, he wouldn't say God, but there are certain built-in laws in the nature that would result in the prebiotic soup and cause it to get more and more complex and cause life forms to change and so on. And a theistic evolutionist would say God and put those laws in. And he intervened at certain major points, such as the Cambrian, the advent of man and so on, the creation of the universe. But Dean Kenyon later repudiated his own theory of biological predestination. He said there are no intrinsic laws that cause these things to evolve in a certain ways. In fact, even on the DNA double helix ladder, the phosphates and the sugars and the ATCG nucleotides do not have a natural affinity toward one another. And that's where the rubber meets the road, folks, is at the DNA ladder level. And those chemicals have no innate predestination toward one another. They don't attract one another. In other words, the phosphates don't say, oh, there's a sugar, I'll go meet the sugar. Or there's a adenosine or a guanine nucleotide, I'll go over there and hook up with them. No, it doesn't do that. So if it doesn't work on the genetic level, it can't work on a higher level. Here's some quotes from evolutionists now. Since we have not the slightest evidence, either among the living or the fossil records, or of any integrating types or transitional forms, following the major groups, it is a fair supposition that there have never been any such integrating types. Again, evolutionary theory demands what?
Evidence.
Transitional forms, right?
I can give you transitional forms. Now, there is transitional forms.
I could get into Stephen Jay Gould, but I don't have enough time to discuss him. There's still problems with his presentation, but... Mm-hmm. Oh, I could use him too. But Stephen Jay Gould, an evolutionist, knew that there weren't any transitional forms like this. So what he proposed was small localized populations. You could have rapid evolvement. But even if that were true, you would still have many more
Okay, here we go. Despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Again, this is an evolutionist talking. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them, quote, unquote. These are not creationists. These are evolutionists. Yep. No matter how far back we go in the fossil record of previous animal life upon Earth, we find no trace of animal forms which are intermediate between the various major groups or phyla. And here's, I'm not going to, I don't have time, we're running out, I won't read that, all that, but here's one I like to read. But fossil species remain unchanged throughout most of their history, and the record fails to contain a single example of a significant transition or intermediate form. So the point is that, and I have a lot of other quotes from evolutionists saying that, and believe me, if there were intermediate forms, they would be saying there were intermediate forms. When you... Oh, a lot. No, I would contend just the inverse would be true. Yeah. If you start with an assumption that God is not real, of course you're going to make certain assumptions after that. Now, okay. It's 12:30. I'd like to end briefly on a note of information. Okay? That's a big quandary for the evolutionists, is the rise of information. So far, in talking to like a college student, or anybody else for that matter, is that you have the sudden appearance of the universe, requiring a creator. You have design, which shows a designer. You have the sudden appearance of life at the beginning, and you have the sudden appearance of life at all the major groupings of animals with no pre-transitional forms. You have the sudden appearance of life after major extinction events. And lastly, you have the sudden appearance of information. Now, why is that, real quick, why is information important? What's a quick answer for that since we're out of time? Yes. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a software program create itself, or would you ever think in your right mind that a software code could create itself? Of course not. Of course not. Come on. Bill Gates said the genetic code, you know, might, it looks like computer programming, except on a level far beyond our comprehension. Software codes don't happen by chance. Information does not happen by chance. And the genetic code is far more complex than any pieces of information or conglomerates of pieces of information that mankind has ever come up with. So in your real life, if you go down to the beach and you see a heart drawn on the shore, John loves Gloria, my wife. Got out of that one. I'll explain later, dear. Nobody in their right mind is going to say a wave came up by chance and created that writing. Nobody. Come on. The genetic design, and John didn't write it either. But so the genetic code, which would be equivalent to millions and millions and millions and millions of Britannica encyclopedias inscribed into the sand on the shore. How could that happen by chance? Information never, ever happens by chance. Meaningful information. Complex information. So that just about does. That's how I would approach it to anyone out there, or especially a young person. And I would probably ask them a few more questions than I've presented here. Try to make them think certain things out a little more and wait. Give them 5 minutes to pontificate. Don't have that time here, but I think you've seen the general approach is. Yes, sir.
I have an image. I have to look it up for you. It's an issue of National Geographic, and they're great.
Oh, yes.
In evolution, they have an issue on one of the early hominid species that has incredibly long fingers and toes and all these features.
Mm-hmm.
And in their
Well, bipedal primates need money too. I mean, come on. Yeah, you got to be careful of the flesh and bone type of graphics, you know. But to close with to Al. Yeah. For those of you who don't know, Al's a beloved member of the class, and so we can have a little fun with him occasionally. So let's end in prayer. Lord, thank you very much for this time to examine your universe, your life, and just the wonder of it all. And when the more we look, the more we see design and your touch of creation. Help us to be able to use this information in a loving way, sensitive way, to people that we meet that may believe different than we do. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, so.